Welcome to Awaken Calls. Every Saturday, we host conversations with guest speakers from all walks of life. Speakers whose personal journeys awaken and inspire our innate spirit of service. Thank you for coming together to plant seeds for a more compassionate society.
Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening, everyone. My name is Alyssa, and I'm really excited to be your host for our weekly Global Awaken Call. Welcome, everyone, and thank you so much for joining us. Global work allows us to hold this beautiful space. We are thankful to them and to all of our listeners for helping to co-create this space. Today, we are grateful to have a remarkable guest speaker with us, Lara Galinsky, whose personal journey is not only inspiring, but has had a tremendous impact on many people around the world. Thank you again for joining us for today's call. Let us go ahead and start with a minute of silence to anchor ourselves into this space. Welcome again to our weekly Awaken Call, today in conversation with Lara Galinsky. So here is how the call works. In a few minutes, our moderator, Pavi Mehta, will engage in a deep dialogue with our speaker, Lara. And by the top of the hour, we're going to roll into a Q&A session in a circle of sharing. And that's the point where we will invite all of your reflections and questions. What I've done is I've opened up the queue right now, so if at any point you would like to be part of the circle of sharing and asking questions, you can hit *6 on your phone, and you'll be prompted when it's your turn to speak. Again, that portion will happen at the top of the hour. You can also email us at ask@servicespace.org with any of your questions, and we will do our best to have everyone's questions answered, and we will get everyone involved to the extent possible. So we have the great pleasure of having Pavi as our moderator today. For those of you who don't know, Pavi has had a lifetime of service. Pavi and her family created and served in the Aravind Eye Hospitals and Clinics in India, which have provided free vision care to tens of millions of people in India and have saved countless from blindness. Pavi is also a key founder and leader of the service-based community, as she's pioneered such initiatives as the Daily Good, which has stories that have touched thousands of people around the globe. So I'd like to go ahead and invite Pavi to introduce our moderator and today's call.
Thanks so much, Alyssa. It's a pleasure to be moderating this call with you. I wanted to go ahead and introduce our guest, Lara, so we can launch into our conversation with no further ado. Early on in her career, Lara Galinsky was National Program Director at Do Something, where she worked with 20,000 educators and 4 million young people to organize service learning and community service projects. She would go on to become Senior Vice President at Echoing Green, a 30-year-old platform that has supported hundreds of young social change innovators from across the world, who then went on to launch projects like Teach for America, City Year, One Acre Fund, Public Allies, and more. Lara is the co-author of two books, Work on Purpose and Be Bold. She's currently involved in several initiatives, among them serving as a coach for impact-driven leaders and as the entrepreneur-in-residence at the startup Future Laboratories, a social innovation incubator for new solutions to entrenched problems in America. She also serves as a business developer for the Women's Building, a groundbreaking new project led by the Novo Foundation to create a physical space for activism, community, and reclamation by women and girls. In one of her most significant life roles, she is a single mom to a 4-year-old boy named Isaiah. It is a joy to have her with us on the call today. Welcome, Lara.
Thank you so much for that introduction. I really appreciate it.
Well, thank you for making the time to be with us today. I wanted to just dive right in to our conversation. And I was reading one of your posts on the service-based feed, and in it you describe yourself as someone who is always intensely mission-driven, and your path and many accomplishments certainly illustrate that. I was wondering if you could take us back a bit and paint a picture for us of your formative years, your childhood, and some of the influences, people, events, life moments that helped shape you into this deeply purposed person that we get to listen to today?
Oh, thank you for that question. And it's funny, it reminds me of a post that I wrote a few years ago where I talked about when I was interviewing people. You know, part of my role in the past was bringing a lot of people into my organization. And one of my practices was asking people about their formative years. So one of the practices was, you know, so tell me about yourself. And people would say, well, you know, I graduated college or I did this and the last job was this. And I would say, no, go back. And they were like, how far back? High school? And I'm like, no, let's go even further back. Because I really do believe, and as many others with a lot more research acumen behind them know that those formative years and the families we grow up in, the communities that nurture us, the schools that we attend, those loving and mentoring relationships that we have, are those are the things that really become central forces in our lives. And so to get to know someone, you really do need to go back there. And for me, I grew up in New York, and I came from a family where it was such a blessing. And I realized at one point, I think probably not until high school, how unique this was, but it was grew up in a family that believed that if you're blessed to be spending time on earth, you should be blessed to choose what that is that's most meaningful and go for it. And that was not a privilege. It was really an obligation to yourself and to your community to be able to go through that journey to identify it. And that really came from my parents' example. My father was really a strong scientist, became a chemical engineer, and was really sort of on this upward mobile career, but was deeply unhappy. And this was before I was born. And the story goes that my mom got she was a teacher, and she got a tiny little raise, and that was enough to take the bold move for him to quit completely from his engineering, sort of, you know, making polymers job, and go become an artist, which is what he just was a hobby that was just encaptured him. And so he, having very little experience, got his MFA, was one of the early classes of an MFA program here in New York City at Columbia, and has been an artist and a healer, Qigong master for the last 40 years. And that example of crafting your life around that of which captures you really came alive through that story. And my mom, the way I describe her as a pioneer, she taught me that life can be, work life, or just life in general, can be a navigation of the questions that capture you the most. And those questions are not ones that you can easily answer. They're ones that you actually have to spend a lifetime or a decade really grappling with. And the questions that really spoke to her early in my upbringing was really, why is there such a separation between and a competition and a tension between work life and family life? That there was just and what does it mean for more and more women to develop careers? And what is the best and highest, most supportive environments for kids? And how do kids learn? And those are some of the questions that she has created in her career, running an organization called the Families and Work Institute, and developing curriculum and models around the neuroscience of learning, early learning, called Mind in the Making. And that example really was all about sort of the inquiry process and discovery. And if you don't have answers, you can actually spend your career and your life navigating them. You might hear some New York City noises in the background, so forgive me for the sirens that will inevitably come into our presence. And so my upbringing centered around that example, and I do feel very fortunate that that led me to finding an organization called Do Something around the time I graduated from college. And it was one of those things that I learned about the organization's mission somehow, some way, and it seeped into my dreams. I thought about it. It just captured me viscerally. this idea that young people can change the world, and this is sort of in the height of teenagers are dangerous and apathetic and are just a drain on society and cause violence and are lazy, et cetera, et cetera. And this organization do something was completely counter to all these norms that were put out in the media, et cetera. And I just had to work there. And I think that's been one of my major lessons, is really understanding what captures you, figuring out how to get there, or figuring out that how, even if you don't end up there, that part of the process is a journey that unfolds other opportunities.
Thank you for that quick sketch of sort of some of the influences in your life. And what a remarkable story about your father and your mom.
Yeah.
That they took that, you know, leap of faith together, and to think like how different his life could have turned out had he not, you know, done that and followed his passion. I was wondering, like, and especially given your mom's involvement with teaching and children, like, were there any special teachers in your life who kind of helped, you know, forge your
path? So many. I remember, you know, when I was really young, I had a teacher, Barbara McAllister, who was actually in the process, it was very sad, it was very formative, but she was in the process of dying. She had cancer. And I was too young to fully understand it, but it really stayed with me. It stayed with me my whole life, how beloved she was in the community, and how the community sort of took on this challenge of an amazing woman, amazing teacher, and someone who was dying, sort of all as one unit, you know, one fluid, amorphous unit. And
how did that come? Like, how did you? Because that seems like a deep lesson. Like, how did that manifest itself? A community.
Yeah, and I couldn't have been more than 4.
Oh wow.
Which is my son's age now. So I think, she left at the middle of the school year. She was in the hospital. I remember visiting her. I think what was really remarkable is and I feel this tendency in my own parenting, which is the, do I protect, right? Is my son too early to absorb something? Or actually, is this a beautiful demonstration of just the reality of the ups and downs of life? And my mom took me to the hospital to say goodbye, and I remember it. I remember in the hospital, and what's so interesting is for my family is that up until that point, I had been asking my family for a dog. I wanted a dog. I knew what kind of dog. I knew what I wanted to name the dog, and I remember that Barbara said to my mom, "Get Laura a dog," and indeed, a woman who was dying, her words to my mom had extra weight to them, and indeed I was able to get a dog from there.
Oh,
and she sort of enabled something that became really important to me. And one other teacher, it's another teacher, and I'm really paying attention to this as, again, a parent who is observing the type of relationships that my son is having with his teachers. And not all of them are, you know, I'd say it becomes really special. And another teacher, Suzanne Carruthers, was my 3's teacher. And she took copious notes of all of her, and this is handwritten notes, right, back in the 70s, handwritten notes of all of her students and what she was noticing. And she had deep, long sessions with parents about what she was noticing. And it was just very, 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 I mean, it's like, you know, pre-K now is even at 4, but at 3, this was sort of unusual back in the 70s. And I was blessed, and she was so child-led, you know, she would really listen deeply to what children wanted. And I remember one day, I had to cross a bridge to get to school, and there was a toll booth, and we had little tickets to go across the toll, and I remember that I was fascinated by the toll booth people who would sit in these little booths all day long taking tickets, and I thought, wow, that's so powerful. that they allow entrance to the bridge, which allowed entrance to New York City, which allowed, you know, and it just, to me, I came to school one day as a threat of wanting to be a toll booth operator. And I remember that Suzanne created this whole play around building a bridge out of blocks, creating a little toll booth, and we all, and creating little tickets, you know, this is a three-year-old memory, and we played toll booth. And, you know, it's, and I'm blessed that we were able to stay in touch with Suzanne, and she was able to find those notes from when I was three. She had had a system that organized it beautifully, and many, many years later, at my baby shower, she read some of those notes to me as sort of a gift. And what was so remarkable, and I think this goes back to your first question about people's early influences and how poignant they are, what she described as when I was three is me, is really me as a three-year-old. I mean, you know, of course, there's some things that don't fully resonate, but I think 90% of it, I was like, yeah, that sounds like me. And that was a big lesson around who we are is who we are, and so much of life is around sort of unlearning the things that are calcifying or just creating things that layer on top of who we really are that hides us, and we have to chip away at that.
Yeah. It also speaks to the power of having someone witness that, you know, someone who sees, who sees and pays attention and is really tuning in and not necessarily trying to force you down a predetermined path, but really seeing, like, what is this, you know, seed of a child? Like, what is she? And what is she, you know? What does she hold inside her?
I was describing to someone yesterday, actually, what it means to hold space. It's a term that not everyone is familiar with. And you just sum that up in many ways. It's really about the presence, someone's presence that's just affirming, and how unbelievably powerful that can be in that process of self-discovery.
Yeah, and it's just interesting that, like, you know, even the first organization that you joined, like Do Something, is it assumes that we all are aware that we can do something, you know, like that we have that potential. And not everyone, I think, lives into that potential fully, or is, you know, and so to have early influences that remind you of your capacities is
so important. I mean, I love that. I often play this game in my head, which is the what if game. Like, what if every single child on earth was able to spend time and affirm their highest and best dream for themselves and the people around them? Like, what would the world look like? How would it be different if there was just the affirmation that's just normal, or just a space to do that work?
Yeah, it's a powerful question to hold, and I think it immediately leads to this question of, like, how can I be that affirmation, you know?
Yes.
In those moments, like, what are those micro moments of opportunity?
What are those micro moments? And also sort of this notion that it's not only what it's the power of your being is actually what influences other people. Your example, and just people watching, absorbing, and that kind of osmosis.
It's, you know, I want to talk a little bit to you about your book, Work on Purpose, and because I think it kind of leads, you know, where we are right now, and the conversation is kind of leading into it. In a description of the book, I saw these words where it said, career choice is a destination, not a decision, and having the right tools to navigate the ride is essential. And I wanted to see if you could talk a little bit about career pathing, as you call it, and how you see it, and what does it mean to you to see your career as a destination and not a decision?
Right. It's funny the way the sort of standard way we career path in America, at least, feels very sort of practical and not about dreaming and not about sort of deep inquiry and unfolding and discovery. Because the reality of having to make money in emerging adulthood is sort of the dominant pressures. It's almost like you go from, it's like you're sort of just that little bird that was dropped from the nest and you just have to figure out how to fly, and you don't, there's like, it's a necessity to fly as opposed to a, like there, and any sort of time and space for, and knowing that it just, there's no fundamental right answer as much as there's a one step in front of the other, or one wing flapping mm-hmm. at a time. I think that having is, the way I think about it is that career, like life, is a journey, and that because there's so much research on people's unhappiness at work and the disengagement at work, that there's really sort of a, in my mind, sort of a crisis, like just such lost potential. And my thought about it is one of the most important processes that is really sort of informal and brushed aside, and there's so much unhappiness and unrest around it, so that there's like something really fundamentally wrong. So my process was like, well what would look more right? What would feel better? Where can people kind of unleash or unlock themselves more? Like, what are the conditions? And I think taking some pressure off, thinking that there is very few people in my experience have a straight path where there's no left or right turns off into the woods, or, you know, swim in the pool or lake or whatever. Very few people just sort of know that they want to do this and then they just take the steps to get there. And even some of those people who know that they want to be this role get there and then feel dissatisfied. And then there's this kind of crisis of identity. But more regularly, I see lots of people go through these ebbs and flows of knowing, unknowing, getting somewhere, and then seeing lots of things that are dissatisfying to them around certain roles and jobs, and even just a sort of figuring out the right place to be, or how to best use one's skills. And so the first thing that I think of is it's a journey. And there's no sort of right answer as much as the best thing to do right now. And then the second is actually taking some pressure off and thinking about work as work in the world, as opposed to the work that you get paid for. And that there's so many different ways to kind of fill up one's life with things that are significant. And that doesn't always have to be lined up perfectly with the things that you get paid for. And I think that taking kind of the wide lens on one's life, so friendships could be part of your work in the world, your service to other organizations in a volunteer capacity, a board capacity. I love the notion of projects. I think there's something so beautiful about this idea of creating something, putting out into the world somehow in some way, that may or may not last. And it really isn't about perpetuating its existence as much as being open to the fact that it has a moment in time that can fold or unfold depending on what happens. So there's sort of a lightness to projects in some ways. And so thinking about career as different projects, I think, is another way of thinking about it. So those are some of the kind of things that I've noticed. And I think the biggest one I'm sort of coming to something the most important last, which is that an element of aligning work with what's meaningful and work in the world with what's meaningful is really the trick.
It's really quite your way, your perspective on these things, the word that comes up for me is just like really freeing, you know, not...
Yeah.
And I can imagine that for many people that these are conventional ways of thinking about work can feel very confining and heavy. And there's that beauty of knowing that it doesn't have to be that way, you know, like that a shift in perspective can change so much. And I was also thinking about that, what you said about leaning into the not knowing and kind of the ebbs and flows of knowing and not knowing, and thinking about how we're so weighted towards knowing as a culture, like that unknowing feels awkward, it feels, you know, inelegant, it feels almost like you have to be apologetic for not knowing.
Yeah. You're stuck, right? You're not your best self when you're not knowing. And what if that was reframed around, oh, this is fun. I don't know what I want to do. How exciting that I get to kind of try some things on and see and have the capabilities, those skills we talked about, to know when I do know, but be okay with not knowing as well. It really is about taking that pressure off, but taking action. Right? Inertia is in some ways the enemy.
Yeah. And I almost feel like what you're indicating is that there's a dignity in not knowing.
There's a dignity. Yeah. It is literally an important part of the process. It's like when you're working out, right? It's the breaks between the reps. It's the space, the oxygen.
Yeah, and from there, like, I feel like this is very naturally leading into another sort of important cornerstone of your work has been talking about, like, helping people find their moment of obligation.
Yes.
And that's another word, obligation, that I think is heavy for some people or loaded.
Kind
of implying, like, an unwelcome sense of duty and, you know, more from your head than from your heart. And so I was wondering, like, what does that word mean to you, and is there do you have a moment of, you know, where you found your obligation that you can share with us?
Yeah, so moment of obligation is in some ways, it's moments of obligation, and the obligation is actually to yourself, that you are what you got, and you are you, and your commitment to being your best you is up to you, right? It's not anyone else's no one else can do it like you by any stretch of the imagination. So the obligation, it really is a reframe of the word obligation. And there are moments, there are times, there are incidents, there are experiences that we all have that reveal what's true. I'm putting quotes around the word true, for you, for ourselves. In other words, what's significant, what's meaningful, what's purposeful. And too many times, I think, in particular, the culture that I grew up in, you don't recognize those moments. We're not trained to listen to the messages of the heart or of the part of us that isn't deeply inspired or connected to something. And so part of moment of obligation comes from this idea of training ourselves to stop and pause and recognize them. They come in many moments. They come in a range of emotions. So you can imagine being deeply inspired and not being able to forget. You know, as I talked about learning about Do Something's mission and thinking and feeling, oh my gosh, to me that was a very rare moment, and it was so sticky, right? But it can also come in moments of rage or unhappiness about something in the world where you're like, I can't, like, this is not right, right? Some sort of justice piece is woken up. It can come in moments of love, deep, deep, deep love and affection for a place, a person, a population, a culture. And for me, I've had many, many moments, and I think sometimes they're big ones, significant ones, that are sort of like a scream, like you can't ignore me, or maybe not a yell, but like but something that has louder volume. But most of them are actually
smaller moments that really gather in strength and power by being someone who can notice patterns, right? Mm-hmm. And one of the highest skills I think that you can develop in your lifetime is being able to notice patterns. And noticing patterns of your moment of obligation is one of those highest, because it's revealing to you what's meaningful. And that is a mechanism that can allow your destination or even, I will say, decisions around your life to come true. And so for me, one of my moments of obligation was around being captivated by the construct of purpose. Like, I remember being, so for many years I worked at Echoing Green, 12 years I worked for Echoing Green, and it is such a beautiful mission. So people from all around the world, thousands of people who have big, bold ideas to address a deeply, deeply entrenched problem, hunger, homelessness, right, inequities in education, healthcare, human rights. They come with really innovative, groundbreaking, new ways, new approaches to solve those problems. And I've been doing it for many, many years and helping to support these individuals, right? So sort of through this competitive process, only a few would receive a fellowship, and they were the ones who were launching organizations around their solution. And people loved Echoing Green Fellows. They were revered. They were people saw a little part of themselves in the fact that they were bold enough to kind of take an idea and bring it to life. And people often said, oh, wow, these individuals can do anything, and they're choosing to spend their time doing this. And then it hit me. One of my moments of obligation was actually recognizing that there's so many things that made Echoing Green Fellows or people who launch new solutions or construct a life around something powerful and solution-driven. There's so many things that make them special. But it hit me that actually what really fundamentally captured my own imagination was that they found purpose. Hmm. And then that led me, it like literally was one of those aha moments where I was like, oh, these people found purpose and then made decisions based on that and crafted a life based on that. And look at them. They're kind of, it's not that they don't have hardships or challenges or failures. They have it all, just like all of us, or unhappiness. But there is something fundamentally powerful and really extraordinary about purpose. And that led me, because I was trained enough, attuned enough, to that frequency of noticing that I was in a moment of obligation, that I had to understand purpose more. And that led me down another journey.
That's a beautiful story there. And I'm just thinking of those 12 years when you were immersed in that world of young change makers from all over, different countries, cultures, backgrounds, and what that must have been like. And I was struck by your phrase about the importance in noticing patterns as being one of the most meaningful things we can do. And two parts to the question. The first is, can you speak a little bit more about that? Like, why do you see that as such an important and profound skill? And the other is, in that time, the 12 years that you spent working with some of the best and brightest social entrepreneurs of the world, what were some of the patterns that you noticed?
Yeah, So why is pattern recognition so important, such an important skill? I think in the sort of highest, that part of our life journey is around implementing and learning big things that we need to learn, like really, really big things that have gotten our way, that are unleashing or unlocking moments, as I said before. And sometimes it takes a lot for us to learn those learnings, and that the skill of being able to recognize patterns is actually what, because it will keep showing up, the lessons, the big learnings will keep showing up in our lives and as a pattern, and our reaction becomes a pattern often if we're not learning it. And so being able to say, oh gosh, like I keep on getting the same type of relationship dynamic with the same person. And even though they're so different, these people, I think, yet I'm now noticing that this dynamic shows up again and again in my life, that becomes a real big clue about some of those big lessons or learnings that one's life is all about. So that's sort of why I think that's on the highest point, why I think pattern recognition is so vital. I think that around the patterns that I recognized in social entrepreneurs, I think one thing that was so remarkable about their example was the ability to just take risks and have a comfortable relationship with risk-taking. Hmm. That's a pattern I saw in most social entrepreneurs. They're calculus of even if I fail, it's worth it, was yeah. super, super, you know, they went through that thought process and came out on the other end of, I just have to do it. Right? So that was one pattern that I saw. I think that another pattern I saw in social entrepreneurs that were able to thrive is the ability to really get out of the way, know what they were good at, and then surround themselves and give, really create a collective around them. Hmm. So that there was a community of people who are taking things on and being their best selves, right? It's like the notion of collective genius. We can't and we don't do things alone. We do things together. And part of being a really strong leader is creating that collective and knowing how to kind of be an orchestra leader as opposed to the person with the loudest instrument.
Yeah, those are great.
The conductor,
Great patterns. And I was wondering, like, you know, to me, like, the field of social entrepreneurship so strongly brings together, like, that balance of head, heart, and hands.
Yeah.
And there's something so, it just captures, you know, the imagination at, like, so many different levels to see, you know, our human life being used in that way. And I was wondering, like, in the patterns that you saw, were there any common patterns of pitfalls or certain slippery slopes that you noticed?
You mean in social entrepreneurship in general as a field?
As a field.
Yeah. Oh, for sure. I think those who are thinking about the entrepreneur as opposed to the collective, as I said earlier, I think it just doesn't work, right? If creating the change that we desire, that we dream about, takes a lot of forces, and it's not really an individual effort. So those who don't recognize that and build leadership in all will not get that far. I think that there's been a lot of sexiness around for-profit social change organizations without the really hard, rigorous diligence of what corporate form makes the most sense and why, and is there the capital that I need? I mean, I think that we saw so many for-profits sort of die in the vine because they just weren't capitalized. It's still early in the world of impact investing. I think things are still roiling. We're still figuring things out. But it's a really important tool. So it is about figuring out the tactics and being flexible. I think that knowing when to leave, ooh, that's a big one. Mm. That is such a big one. Sometimes people leave too early and the organization and the work just is not sustained. There isn't enough systems or strong theory of change or leadership bench to keep it going. And I think in other times, people stay too long. I often thought about that. am I staying in my role too long? And I think ultimately I did. And I think that was a big lesson for me. Knowing when to leave to provide room for others and often for your own self. I think that the amount of, and I think you see this in social change. You see this in New York City. You see this all over. It's a real fundamental problem is burnout. Just people are dry inside. They can't have the rigorous thinking. They're stuck in the minutia, or they're over tap schedules. They're working too hard. And they just can't get out of that quagmire. And I've seen lots of social entrepreneurs sadly just hit that point of I can't, I won't, and I'm not.
Yeah.
And they have to, for their own heart, their own health, their own life, they have to leave. And that's a crisis too. Yeah.
Yeah, and I know in your own work that you've done a lot around coaching, and that you currently also play that role for, you know, impact-driven individuals. And I was thinking about like just how, you know, in my own life, I'm sure for many of our listeners it's the same. We've had mentors or, you know, people that we can turn to sort of as sounding boards, as, you know, guideposts even. And I'm wondering in this work, like, what do you see the role of coaching to be? And I know you talked about normalizing it, like to have it be something that's more accessible and part of the culture.
Yes. Thank you so much for that question. I believe in every part of my being that everyone on earth can benefit from a coaching relationship. It does not have to be formal. It does not have to be paid. But having someone or something that allows someone to feel heard, to be affirmed, and at the same time asking hard questions that reveals what's already inside someone. The benefit of coaching is that it creates a relationship that is both incredibly empowering, puts you in your driver's seat of your life, but it also is not easy. It's designed to be challenging. It's designed for you to have some hard conversations with yourself. Mm-hmm. And life can pass us by without us asking those hard questions. They show up in other ways, for sure, those crisis moments, the burnout, the emptiness that people feel often. But I do think that coaching allows for that in one's life in a way that is also creates the capabilities and tools for people to do it to themselves. So I've gone in and out of coaching relationships where I've had a coach for a period of time. I haven't had a coach. But even when I don't have a coach, I have a coach inside of me. And I've been a coach professionally with clients, and I've also done it really informally in my friendships. Even as a mom, it shows up because it's just a way of being. And it's an inherent notion of coaching I love so much, which is you're whole and you have the answers. You are whole and you have the answers inside of you. And it really is about the kind of opening up and discovery process. And sometimes it takes someone else to really enable that. But it's not always needed.
Yeah. That's so interesting. It just makes me wonder, like, what are the qualities and the practices that you try to bring to your notion of coaching?
Deep listening. Deep, deep, deep listening. In coaching, we talk about third-level listening, which is not just what people are saying. It's also about what people are not saying. It's watching body and voice. It's also observing the things around us, right? Everything, the sirens, right? The neighbors, the sounds of birds and of cars, all mixed. And that kind of listening, I think, allows for deeper insights, for hunches to emerge more clearly. I think that one of the things I've noticed in coaching, which is one of those life skills that is so applicable to just about anything, is the art and science of asking questions. I realized before coaching, although I always thought of myself as a good question asker, I really wasn't as strong a question asker as I wanted to be. I hadn't learned it. It's not something that, you know, maybe we learn the Socratic method and maybe we, you know, but it wasn't something that I had really absorbed. And I, a lot of questions are actually masked opinions.
That's a great way of putting it.
Yeah. And I think a lot of questions are also, we don't listen to the answers because we've already formulated a point of view. And so we're just looking for confirmation. So I think so much of question asking is around being open, right? Open and honest. Those are the two qualities that, that good questions are, embed in them. I think that's another piece of coaching. So it really is about listening. It's about another piece that I think is really powerful is frameworks. Coaching is frameworks. Right, so it borrows from so many different modalities and methods. Right, there's an element of positive psychology. There's an element of it's certainly not therapy, but it does have sort of a therapeutic air to it. There are elements of Buddhism and meditative practices that are part of a coaching relationship. And so I think that there's being able to kind of think through some frameworks that are really effective in deeply reaching people. And I think that that becomes the soup that you're stirring, that becomes the food that nourishes you when you're kind of in your own or in a coaching relationship. If you're coaching yourself as an individual or if you're in an actually formal coaching relationship, those kind of three things.
That's such a rich answer to that. And I feel like it connects directly in a way to parenting too. And I imagine that just that your experience and your perspectives on coaching weave their way into your way of being a parent.
Yeah, I try. Parenting has been right. You know, how is your? Tell me about your day. Tell me when you laughed the hardest. You know, right? Because how's your day? Fine, good. You know, like, like the questions just don't land.
Yeah.
But then when you're asking more sort of like rich, nuanced questions, more things come up, and then stories emerge from it. You know, a lot of coaching, another piece of it, and I think this is a perfect alignment with parenting, is letting go. I think that's a lot about leadership, is letting go. Know when not to let go and know when to let go is leadership too. And so much of parenting is like, all these constructs about everything come up when you have this little mirror in front of you, right?
Yeah, I can imagine.
You're like, I'm a really relaxed parent and let you be who you are. And then you're like, then all these things about like, but that doesn't mean, that means that you have to read by, you know, X age. And then you're like, wait a second, who cares? You know, so there's this constant, in my mind, inner dialogue about what I care about and what I don't care about, and not go on automatic, right? When you go on automatic, it's like the lowest common denominator. So it's disrupting patterns, speaking of patterns, to be able to let go of those things that are just truly not important and really have that deep sense of knowing and then a pathway to elevate the things that are really important to you. And for me, what's really important in my parenting relationship is creating the conditions. It's like a coaching relationship. It's like a leadership relationship. Creating the conditions for someone to be who they are and want to be from day one.
That's great. And, I feel like the thing that I'm wondering what your perspective on this would be. Like, what is the relationship between, I guess, whether it's coaching or parenting, and empathy?
Yeah, empathy is an interesting word. I struggle with the word empathy, and maybe it's just language, right? I like the word perspective taking. It's a little less emotional, and believe me, those who know us know me know I like the emotions, but there's something around, there is a practice around when you're stopping yourself trying to understand where they're coming from. That is an unbelievably powerful tool in parenting. So it's like literally from getting on the floor and just seeing what they see, that practice, and understanding the fears and the struggle between being independent and dependent. I love you. Get away from me. I love you. I want to be on my own. And that kind of that struggle and really just kind of understanding what's going on with them. For so long, parents or the kind of the norm is, oh, little babies, nothing's going on, right? They're not doing anything. All they do is sleep and eat and cry and actually, when you realize how much is going on in behind those eyes, right? And just like the amount of work and brain development and just like that perspective taking is an incredibly powerful tool. One of the other things that as a parent I've learned, and that it's so applicable for everything. I think so much of parenting is just like, just spills into other parts of your life. Especially on patience and other elements is not solving things. Letting things happen, and then helping when there's a challenge and there's a stuck, helping my son in particular figure out a solution that works for him. That's coaching as well, right? So it's like the difference between asking questions and giving advice. Not to make advice have a dirty word, be a dirty word, but in some ways I think it kind of is. because it just doesn't fully absorb. It's your perspective about what you think. And sometimes people really want to hear that, but it's actually just checking in and making sure that you're not solving things and that you're helping people kind of unearth things that they want to do themselves. And it just lands so much better in that way.
Is it something that comes really naturally to you now? Because I can imagine it must take a lot of discipline too, to not, especially when it's such a deep relationship and you care so much, like to not want to jump in and fix or to solve.
Yeah. Well, no, I have to say, so much of my early parenting, I was exhausted. I was deeply tired, and I just wanted to things to be easy. And so there are many moments where I went the easy route. And as I'm gaining a little bit more energy and a lot more perspective taking, now it's so much easier to stop myself so I don't get into that pattern of making things kind of going the easier route of just like making things going away or solving the problem. And so it's becoming much more natural to me. It becomes our pattern, our dynamics, to the point now where my son's like, I know my mom is going to ask me what my plan is to solve the problem, even before I ask him. Or as I pick him up, he's ready to answer the question how did he laugh, or what did, you know, what was joyous about today, to the point now where, you know, another pattern of ours is before we eat, we give thanks. And so he will, sometimes I'll forget and he'll grab my hand.
Aww.
And he'll say, "Mom," you know, so it's seeped into our relationship and into my son's consciousness in a way that makes me infinitely happy.
That is beautiful. And this is a, thank you so much, Lara. This is a great place to hand over to Alyssa. We're at the top of the hour.
Thank you. Appreciate it. Thank you so much, both of you. Thank you. This has been such a rich discussion. And I would like to alert anyone who would like to join in the conversation. You can join the queue by pressing *6. Or if you have any questions, you can email them to ask@servicespace.org. But I've just been, you know, really in awe of the conversation. There's so many gems there, and I really appreciate, you know, the insight into your formative years, Lara, and into your perspective on career pathing and social entrepreneurship and coaching and parenting. And, you know, when you talked about question asking, it actually kind of reminded me of, there's this quote from Krista Tippett where she said something to the effect of, the strength of a question is measured by the honesty and eloquence it elicits. And, you know, when you were talking, it kind of reminded me of that.
Love that.
Yeah. And, yeah, so there's so much there. And I had a question for you before we you know, see if there's any other questions out there. And my question was, I was really moved by the story you told about the teacher who took such copious notes of you at a young age and, you know, when it was able to kind of relay some of those notes later. And you'd mentioned that the thing that was interesting about that was you got to hear things that reminded you of, like, yeah, that's me. You know, that's who I was. That's who I am. And, you know, it kind of made you realize that, you know, a lot of our life is about kind of unlearning habits that we develop as we grow older and, you know, that the sort of layering that happens, you know, as you grow up and as you kind of forget your kind of early and true self. And so I guess with that in mind, I was just kind of curious. I mean, just on a kind of personal level, were there any habits that you felt you had to kind of unlearn in order to return to that early self?
Yeah, such a beautiful question. Thank you for asking that. I think that, so I grew up in New York City in a pretty fast-paced, competitive environment. And even though I had the parents I described who were never told me to do my homework and never, I didn't even have grades until I hit high school, which was
wow.
A shock to me. I was like, grades? What? This is silly, right? Like, how could you, you know, all these questions that came into my mind about education and how it was structured and all that. but I think that I still struggled with and continue to struggle with in some ways around what is success, right? Like is it, and the small and meaningful versus the big and bold. And I think
right.
A lot of social entrepreneurs actually get into this pattern around scaling their organization, right? There's so much pressure. Okay, so you did a good job in making a difference in this one block, now get to 20 blocks, now get to the entire city, now get to the whole East Coast, right? Like, what's your scale proposition? Or, of course, you want to have impact so many people, and so few organizations come even close, even within, I mean, it's not even, so few NGOs are able to kind of get to the place where they're putting a significant dent into the problem. For mm-hmm. so many reasons. And at the same time, there's a lot of pressure to do so. And at the same time, what is success? Like, what does it mean to have an impact? And in my competitive environment that I grew up in a little bit, it was big. It was well known. It was megaphone. It was sage on the stage. It was a single leader, great man, you know? So,
right.
And I really had to unlearn that. And that's still a work in progress.
Well, it's interesting that you say that, actually, because we got a question that really dovetails very nicely with what you just said. We got a question from someone who said, there are those who think that the only way to make social change is to do something big and flashy, that it's not enough to just touch one life or one community. And what would you just say to those people? So it's very interesting that you touched on that, given that question. And I know you kind of alluded to that in your response to my question, but if there's anything else, I guess you would like to add to that.
Yeah, I think it's a deep, my personal opinion is small is beautiful, and that people go at the pace that makes sense. You know, what good are you if you work yourself to death? And yes, we need to figure out systems that affect more people, and we need to figure out why and how our systems are perpetuating the gaps between those whose lives are thriving and those who really struggle. And we know a lot of them, right? But at the same time, I think that it reminds me of the beauty of walking, and what and the kind of when you're at a walking pace, you notice things you wouldn't notice. You get to see the bugs beneath your feet. You get to observe the eagle flying above your head in a way that you might miss if you're kind of your eye is on something really massive. And I think the small things really, really, really matter. And that's a shift. I think a lot of the social entrepreneurship field is around the flashy. And we need to figure out how to craft better partnerships, better alliances between the different sectors to be able to get to some affect more people in a way that is significant. But most organizations are not designed to scale. They're just not. And I think there's nothing but beauty in affecting people deeply. And I think it also has to do with just like my definition about impact is evolving, and I see it more as it goes back to something I said before, which is really about who you are and how and your being naturally affects other people. And I think that to me is in some ways the highest purpose is who you are. And that impact on others emanates in incredible ripples that actually does have scale. But it's not about controlled action taking.
Right. And, I mean, you mentioned that earlier. You said a lot of it comes down to the power of your being and the example you set in terms of how that influences people. And, you know, there's a balance between cultivating your being and the sort of inner work and the outer work and doing. And so I guess with that in mind, in terms of your coaching, like how do you encourage social entrepreneurs and other people to kind of make sure that they're still attuned to that inner work and kind of cultivating their being?
I have found that a lot of social entrepreneurs are craving it so significantly and yet feel the weight of the imperative of their mission. And that tension is sometimes just too much for them, and so they kind of fall under the pressure of just doing, being, building the organization, doing everything, and that when given the permission, just all this stuff comes out, and it almost becomes an awakening. I can't tell you how many social entrepreneurs I know who have built a really strong spiritual and meditative practices that have been a game changer in terms of how they run their organizations, at what pace, and in how that kind of influences their whole lives. And it often comes out of a crisis moment of exhaustion or an HR challenge that has mm-hmm. said that they weren't observing or watching, that just like can bring an organization down to its knees. So I do think that inner work, more and more people I know, the more and more they do it, they realize, wow, there's a multiple benefit. Not only am I feeling better and it feels good to invest in myself, in my own health, but also mm-hmm. my organization is better, right? So leaders are so blind. There's so many moments in my time as a leader where I just couldn't see what I needed to see because I wasn't pausing enough.
Right. That's really beautiful because, you know, I'm glad that there's opportunities that you're seeing that opportunities among social entrepreneurs to kind of pause and really reflect and be able to kind of notice that, you know, sometimes the success of an organization isn't about some of those specific action-taking items, but, you know, part of it's about the kind of interior condition of the, you know, of the social entrepreneur and, you know, the people that are working in that capacity. That does play a big role.
I just want to just completely emphasize what you said. It could not be a more important point. It is, in fact, one of the most important learnings that I've had from my work with social entrepreneurs and my work with myself, which is the health of the leader and the self-awareness and the work that the leader, like you can tell when an organization is run by the individuals who are doing work to ensure that they're self-aware, that they're reflective, that they're listening, and that they are being as healthy as they possibly can be, you can tell that organization is different from those that aren't. And so the it's in my mind, I only want to work for organizations where the leader has some practices around their interior life, because I know that is just going to have such an incredible impact on the culture of the organization mm-hmm. In a way that I think most organizational cultures have so many good elements, and then some of the they often take on the pluses and minuses of its leaders.
Mm-hmm.
And knowing that and therefore working on yourself is actually a gift to the impact that you want to have.
Right. I like that you emphasize that, because it's, I think sometimes maybe some of those personal practices, you know, they can be treated as like, you know, maybe something like ancillary to the mission or, you know, but what you're saying is, no, it's a core part of
it's like,
you know, doing well.
It's just as important in some ways as raising money.
Right.
You know, we're the tolerance that we have of leaders who are putting out a mission in one way and then completely taking actions that are in opposition of that mission or lacking integrity, our tolerance is becoming lower and lower. We want our leaders to be full people who line up. And I don't think And I think that's only a good thing. I think it really is a shift around expectations of leadership.
Right. That's a beautiful. I'm glad that you're emphasizing that, because, you know, sometimes I feel like maybe that doesn't get enough attention.
In my mind, one of the practices that I've taken on in some of my work is coaching of individuals and their direct reports, so that they can have the powerful relationship and the powerful conversations that doesn't leave things to fester. And of course, it comes down to like knowing what you want to say, knowing what you don't want to say. But so much is left unsaid because people are afraid or they don't want to hurt or it's not appropriate, and therefore relationships are affected. And who can do their best work when you're not having the conversations, or you let them metastasize and they get to the point where it's just like it's too far gone? I've seen that so many times, and so much, I think, around deliberate relationship building within organizations is like an unbelievable powerful strategy to achieving your mission. But again, mm-hmm. it's not something that people spend time or money on enough, in my mind.
And that's why it can be really helpful to have some of those both formal and informal coaching relationships to
yes,
help
exactly.
people kind of stay attuned to those things. We have a question that's a little. It stems from the Awaken questionnaire that you filled out, and is this is an interesting one. So you said that you two things on your bucket list are matchmaking and doulaing, and in other words, supporting the creation of more love into our world. Can you share a little bit more about what that aspiration comes from for you and what that means for you?
Yeah, thank you for asking that. The, you know, when I think about, so I named my own company Love Ventures, and it's so funny. So many people are like, oh, are you a matchmaking or are you an escort? Or, like, literally, people don't know what to do with it. And when I really think about, so I think purpose is in the domain of virtues and essence and sort of higher level kind of ways of being, as I said before. And for me, that comes down to love. It's like the mama of all qualities in the world. And it's the thing that you can often find in other qualities. So it becomes the thing. It's like the top of the tree. It's like the root, actually, is the better way of saying it. And then other qualities such as compassion or trust. Or, you know, they come from love. And in my mind, what better ways to demonstrate love by helping someone in the birthing process, right? Literally, having a child is for many people, the act of it often comes from a place of love, right, between a couple. Mm-hmm. Or an act of wanting to develop a family between an individual and his or her sort of purpose around being a parent, right. Often, not always. And so it's in essence, being with someone during the birthing process is such a raw animalistic moment, and having support during that where your life is often changing so significantly through that act, to me is like such a hallowed part of someone's life. I don't know, besides, you know, birth, perhaps union, you know, some sort of relationship union, and birth and death. There's some big ones, graduation, but like those are the big moments. And so being able to walk beside someone and support them during those moments, huge demonstration of love. Matchmaking, mm-hmm. you know, with apps now, I guess it's an old art form. So many people don't use it, but I have a secret ambition of just connecting people to their love partners. I try it every so often. You know, yesterday I sort of texted a friend of mine. I said, are you still single? Because I just thought of someone that I thought that she would connect with nicely, who is also single. And so it's really a hobby right now. And it's a very complex hobby, right? Because, you know, if you do a poor job, you know, it can come back and bite you. But in many ways, it's like, wow, you helping to facilitate people falling in love with one another. Like, again, that's like the most, in my mind, the biggest gift you can give. And so I'm just trying to think of what are those big gifts that are just pure demonstrations of love and that create more love.
Right. Well, you know, that's I mean, that's beautiful. I mean, sometimes those, you know, a lot of people, you know, they'll acknowledge that love is an important part of life, but, you know, we spend a lot of our time, you know, not being super attuned to it and only, you know, thinking about it at certain moments. And actually, you know, our own Pavi, I think, had said at one point, you know, we live in a time where we've mastered the art of liking each other on Facebook, but have forgotten the art of loving each other in real life.
And yeah, so, we always have a high bar for love. And I'm like, what if, like, can we have a lower bar of just feeling love? Like, what if actually started with loving everyone? And maybe, like, it's like, opting out, people realize that the best method often is just having people choose to take out and then just assuming something. What if we actually assumed that you love everyone in this world? And then maybe some people you love a little bit less over time. But you just like the baseline. It's like it's such a reversal of how you might walk through the world. And like it's fun to challenge yourself to say, I'm going to demonstrate my love for everyone around me today. So when you're smashed up against someone in the subway and people's, you know, it's hot and people are really cranky, what if you actually take that from a perspective of love? And you smile at someone. Like, it's just like, it's just, it is. And then that smile, instead of you feeling cranky and grumpy and like, it just, it changes everything. And so it's definitely a way of being that I'm aspiring to bring into my life more fully.
Well, that's a really beautiful way of looking at it. And part of it, it sounds like it's kind of just almost an attitude shift and seeing those moments as opportunities. But we have another question that's sort of, about those moments where maybe people lose sight of love and experience trauma. And so the question is, how can our traumatic experiences be skillfully engaged with on the road to purpose?
Yeah, so much of purpose comes out of hardship because we see, so the definition of purpose is beyond the self, right? It is not a self. Purpose is actually, academically, it's actually perceived as something that is bigger than oneself. And so often we notice things that are. So I just want to actually go through the definition. So Dr. Damon from Stanford University, he runs the Center for Adolescence, and he's sort of like the grandparent of the academic world of purpose. His definition, and I love it, is it's a stable and generalized intention to accomplish something that is at the same time meaningful to the self and consequential for the world beyond the self. So consequential for the world beyond the self often comes from seeing the dissonance between what the world could be and what it is and wanting to correct that. Mm-hmm. And often those things happen to ourselves. Most social entrepreneurs that I think are completely, unbelievably powerful, it's their narrative, their story that led them to do the work. It comes from there. But if they haven't sort of dealt, or not dealt, that's not the word I want to use, they haven't worked with what is often experienced as trauma, then they will get in their own way. And so I've seen, and for myself included, I have brought in different methods into my own life to work through some of the trauma, because I knew that I wouldn't be able to be of the best service. And that's just real. Like and that means that we can't always be sort of at our highest point if we're not sort of addressing the things that have shut our body down, where we've been very violated. I'm a big believer in trauma, believing that trauma often gets stuck in the body. So that one of the elements that supports working with trauma is doing body work. And I've personally benefited quite a bit from those types of modalities. It's a wonderful question. Thank you so much for asking it.
Did you? I'm curious. I think that was a beautiful response, and I'm very intrigued when you said you think a lot of trauma is located and gets ends up residing in the body. I think you had mentioned at one point that your father became a Qigong teacher. Did you learn some of that kind of from him? And was that kind of imbued from your early experiences?
Funnily enough, he, and this is sort of typical, none of us, myself, my mom, my brother, we do not know Qigong at all. And yet my dad practices it every single day. My son is often in my dad's art studio watching his really beautiful fluid movements. I've had friends who have studied with my dad. He often works in hospitals, and I've had friends who were dying who elected to work with my dad around energy. and yet it was almost too close. Actually, no, my practice has been more yoga as sort of a central practice. And then more recently, I've been working with EMDR,
which
has been incredibly powerful. It has been powerful for me, knowing that everything is personal and that people have different experiences around different modalities and methods and practices.
That's wonderful. I would second that too. As someone who does both yoga and EMDR, I think those are both great.
Oh, really? You did? Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah. So I'm very happy you said that.
Yeah, very good.
Well, I had heard, I don't want to put you on the spot. I'd heard that you maybe had a Howard Thurman quote that you thought might be apropos, and I just want to make sure you have the opportunity to share that if you'd like. Otherwise, I do have one more question.
Yeah, I'll share it. It really speaks to me, and it talks a lot about it. In many ways, this quote sums up a lot of the different threads that we addressed today that were probably so beautifully surfaced in your question, Fabi. Thank you. So those of you who don't know, Howard Thurman was, he died in 1981, but he was a really influential author, African-American author, philosopher, theologian, educator. He's known as a civil rights leader, and I sort of learned about him as one of the people that most deeply influenced Martin Luther King. And during, he was invited to do the baccalaureate address a year before he died at Spelman College, talking to the 1980 graduates of Spelman College, and he named his speech The Sound of the Genuine. So I'm just going to read three very short paragraphs from The Sound of the Genuine. It really deeply spoke to me when I read it. There is something in every one of you that waits, listens for the sound of the genuine in yourself. And if you cannot hear it, you will never find whatever it is for which you are searching. And if you hear it and then do not follow it, it was better that you had never been born. You are the only you that has ever lived. Your idiom is the only idiom of its kind of all existence. And if you cannot hear the sound of the genuine in you, you will all of your life spend your days on the ends of strings that somebody else pulls. There is in you something that waits and listens for the sound of the genuine in yourself. And sometimes there is so much traffic going on in your mind, so much different kinds of signals, so many vast impulses floating through your organism that go back thousands of generations, long before you were even a thought in the mind of creation, and you are buffeted by these. And in the midst of all of this, you have got to find out what your name is. Who are you? How does the sound of the genuine come through to you?
Wow, that's incredibly powerful. Thank you so much for sharing that. And, you know, I may have to now look that up, and we'll have to share that with the community because you know, that resonated deeply with me, I know, and I'm sure it resonated with others as well.
I'm really glad. Thank you for that.
Well, we just have one final question, and then after that we'll do a minute of silence and express our gratitude for you. The final question I have is, how can we as the larger service-based community support your work?
Oh, thank you. What a beautiful last question. I think that the best way to support, I'll call it this work as opposed to my work, is by each and every one of us doing the work to identify what's meaningful and crafting a life and our destinations and our decisions around that. I think that purpose finding is the most beautiful way that we each can be the most powerful beings. Thank you for that.
Thank you for your response. You know, I think you took what could have been maybe an outward question and you turned it inward on all of us. And, you know, and it kind of, you know, I appreciate that, and that you helpfully reframed the term obligation as something that is really just really looking inward in that kind of process of self-discovery. It's not external, how can I help or save someone else? You just have to, as you've mentioned throughout the call, you know, look inward and discover your purpose and hear the sound of the genuine.
Well put.
So thank you so much. I'd like to invite everyone to hold a collective minute of silence, and then we will collectively express our gratitude. Well, I just want to thank both Laura and Pavi for having this wonderful conversation, and for the questions that we had from everyone. And I think we would all like to really express our gratitude to you, Laura, for your time and for your insight. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you. On the count of three, if we can just say thank you, Laura. One, two, three.
Thank you,
Laura.
Thank you for listening to a recording of Awaken Calls. To access archives, visit us at www.awaken.org. And to get more involved, volunteer at www.servicespace.org.